This week, the NCAA voted to allow colleges to provide their student athletes with as much food as they like. It may sound like a bizarre move, but what the NCAA allows athletes to eat on the college's dime is subject to its own set of rules, and they can sometimes border on the absurd. The move by the NCAA comes at a time when the organization is facing a bit of second guessing about the way it's gone about a traditional role of policing college athletics. We're joined by Joe Nocera from our studio in New York. He's a columnist for the New York Times and has been writing about the NCAA. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Wade.
Let's start with the news this week. More meal money for college athletes. Is this an important development, no big deal, or a strategic retreat by the NCAA?
I vote for C, strategic retreat. You know, they used to have a rule that if you're a student athlete, you could have a bagel, but if somebody put cream cheese on it, that would be a violation of NCAA rules. The NCAA regulates almost every aspect of an athlete's life, and they do it supposedly for competitive balance reasons, but it really has gotten kind of nutty. And I hope that this is the first of many strategic retreats.
The biggest news of late has been a ruling that will allow Northwestern football players to form a union. How do you think that's going to impact NCAA?
Well, I think it already has impacted the NCAA. It has created an enormous amount of awareness of what athletes have to go through, you know, how much they have to work, the extent to which their sport comes before academics, and so on and so forth. So I think it has had a large impact already. The vote is on April 25th, and, you know, the Northwestern coach is on record as saying he wants the players to vote against the union. I suspect it will be an uphill struggle to get the union approved, given the pressure that's on these 18- and 19-year-old kids to vote it down.
And why have a union?
One of the big problems in college sports is that there's nobody advocating for the players. And the idea of having a union is to give the players a seat at the table and to allow them to negotiate for things like improved medical care, guaranteed scholarships. They're not even asking for money at this point. You know, Wade, a large part of the problem here really is that universities of higher education really aren't equipped to be running a major American entertainment complex. And that's what leads to so many of these problems and so much of the hypocrisy that surrounds college sports.
Do you think paying players is coming?
I do. There's a case out there called the O'Bannon case, which is supposed to come to trial in June. It has to do with the licensing rights for athletes and whether the NCAA has the right to those licensing rights in perpetuity. If O'Bannon wins, I think you could very easily see colleges move to an Olympic model where, although they don't get paid for playing, they can get endorsements, they can sign autographs, they can have jobs, they can do other things that put money in their pocket. I think that's a very likely scenario.
Joe Nocera is a columnist for the New York Times. He joined us from New York. All the best, Joe.
Hey, thank you, Wade.
4 years ago, environmental groups monitoring BP's massive oil spill in Louisiana made a troubling discovery. Smaller leaks and spills from the 50,000 rigs in the state's coastal zone frequently go unrecorded. It's a system that relies on polluters to self-report, so they decided to do something about it by plane, boat, and satellite. Bob Marshall of member station WWNO reports.
Jonathan Henderson of the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans is flying Louisiana's coast looking for oil. And as usual, today he's found some.
So I just noticed something out of the corner of my eye that looked like a sheen that had some form to it. And we're going to go take a closer look and see if there's a rainbow sheen.
It's a target-rich environment for Henderson because more than 54,000 wells were planted in and off this coast, part of the 300,000 wells in the state. They're connected by thousands of miles of pipelines, all vulnerable to leaks, and leak they do. Louisiana admits to at least 300,000 barrels spilled on its land and in its waters each year, 20% of the nation's total. But those figures come from a system that depends largely on oil companies to self-report. Now, that problem went mostly unnoticed until the largest spill in U.S. history back in 2010 drew environmental groups to the coast looking for BP's oil.
I started noticing towards the end of 2010 other leaks that were unrelated to the BP disaster. I would find wellheads that were leaking or platforms that were leaking just in the last year, I've filed 50 reports for different leaks and spills unrelated to the BP disaster.
Under the Clean Water Act, when a company spills any amount of oil in the water, it must file a report with the National Response Center run by the Coast Guard. But when Henderson checked, he found many of those smaller spills were not making that list. So environmental groups formed the Gulf Monitoring Consortium to get a better count on the spills. The partnership is a blend of complementary skills. Gulf Restoration has personnel who can spot spills from the air and file complete reports. South Wings, a group of volunteer pilots, helps get those spotters aloft. And a third member, the tech group SkyTruth, based in West Virginia, finds the spills on satellite photographs, then applies a formula used by spill experts to translate the size of the oil sheen into gallons of oil in the water. SkyTruth's David Manthos says its estimates typically are much higher than what's been reported.
We found that the spill was usually 10 times larger than had been reported. And that was averaged out across a lot, so there are some, it was not very easy to see exactly how much distinction there was. In some, the mismatch was much larger than that.
The sheer size of the industry here means there's seldom a quiet day for the consortium. In an average year, the NRC receives 10,000 reports of spills in the Gulf. It's a number that surprised even South Wing's Meredith Dowling, a veteran of many monitoring efforts.
I can't think of a single instance where our volunteers have flown offshore and not found spills. This was something that was really amazing to me when I first moved here. I didn't understand what an ongoing problem this was, that this is a continuous, absolute failure of business as usual practices.
The partners are hoping their work educates the public to the scope of the problem and perhaps gets governments to end the voluntary compliance model and turn to aggressive enforcement by outside groups. Until that happens, consortium members say, they'll keep flying, spotting, and reporting. For NPR News, I'm Bob Marshall in New Orleans.
Bob Marshall reports on coastal issues for The Lens, a nonprofit multimedia news operation. Organic food has taken another step away from its crunchy alternative roots. Walmart, the king of mass market retail, says it will sell even more organic food, and it promises to bring down the price tag as well. Now the question is, will organic producers be able to keep up with demand? Joining me to talk about this is NPR's food and agricultural correspondent Dan Charles. Dan, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Dan, Walmart says it's going to sell organic food more cheaply. But how's it going to do this?
Well, you know, Walmart already sells organic food. But this, they're trying to make a statement saying, we're going to set up our own house brand. It's delivered by a separate company, actually, called Wild Oats. And they're saying, we're going to organize this and we're going to deliver organic food more cheaply. And it's a good question. How are they going to do this? I mean, I actually talked to the CEO of Wild Oats, and he said it's all about logistics. He said, Walmart is the king of distribution, right? And so if we organize the production and the processing and distribution of organic foods on a large scale, there's efficiencies to be had. This is actually kind of an experiment, a test. You know, how much of the extra cost that you pay when you buy organic food, how much of that is just the fragmented nature of the business? How much of it is the small scale aspect, and how much of it is inherent in organic production?
Well, there's no question that Walmart is kind of the king of logistics. But if you talk to some of their suppliers, they'll also complain that Walmart is the king of squeezing them and making them produce the product ever more cheaply at their own expense.
Right. So you could say this is a threat to some organic producers who are used to higher margins. On the other hand, I mean, the organic production is expanding. And if Walmart wants large quantities, they may have to outbid other producers. There is a limit right now on the amount of organic food for sale. They say they want to expand that, and there's no reason why they couldn't. There's lots of land out there. Right now, organic is actually a very small part of American food production. People say 5% or less. So there's no reason why Walmart couldn't expand organic production if they offered a good price. The question is, can they do it cheaply?
Part of this has to do with trust. Are people going to stop going to Whole Foods and go over to Walmart because they can get the eggs $2 cheaper? I'm a little skeptical.
Okay. So this gets to this question of what is organic, really? Because organic has an actual legal definition. You know, it's set out by the National Organic Standards laid down by the USDA, and it has to do with how organic food is produced. No pesticides, no industrial fertilizer, certain other rules like...
Chickens can walk around.
Chickens can walk around, etc. And you can do that on a large scale, and you can do it for Walmart. But organic also, for the consumer, sometimes this cultural image. People think small scale, local, non-industrial, non-Walmart.
Correct.
Right? So, so you can see the organic label kind of splitting. You can get organic eggs for $3 a dozen. You can get organic eggs for $6 a dozen. And the companies that sell them for $6 a dozen say, we are the true organic. We go beyond the strict requirements of these rules. Our milk comes from small family farms. Our chickens have lots of pasture, not just, you know, a door in the side of the chicken house. And we'll tell you where we get our products. You know, we're more true to organic roots. And maybe they will get a certain segment of the market, and the $3 eggs will get another segment.
NPR's food and agricultural correspondent, Dan Charles. Dan, thanks.
Enjoyed it, Wade.
Usually when I do an interview, I'm the one asking the questions. But when I sat down with writer Douglas Copeland this week, he had some questions for me.
Have you ever tried to get rid of a body?
Not a human body, no. Some I was unqualified to answer.
Why do different parts of the body taste different? Why does liver taste like liver, and why does tongue taste like tongue?
And for some reason, this.
Have you ever done a musical?
Like high school kind of stuff.
I can't say.
I like karaoke.
I live in fear of karaoke. My God, we're digressing. Okay.
Digressing from our real topic, Copeland's new novel. It's called Worst Person Ever. It's a profane and shocking book that centers around a completely loathsome individual named Raymond Gunt.
Okay, imagine there was this really bitter English guy who had Tourette's and swore all the time, except he doesn't have Tourette's. He just swears a lot, like a lot, to the point where it almost becomes like performance art.
Raymond is struggling to pay off debt he's acquired, making bad decisions in his miserable life. So he ends up taking a job as a cameraman on a remote island for a reality show.
Which is an extremely thinly veiled version of Survivor, which is a show I love, by the way.
Raymond has no idea what he's getting into. He also has no clue that he really is the worst person ever.
Of course, he thinks of himself as being like Jason Bourne, except he doesn't have a chin over the course of the book. Every woman he's ever really done wrong in his life magically appears one by one until they're all, and hope this doesn't spoil things, trapped on an island together.
And Raymond, as you said, well, he doesn't really think he's done anyone wrong. He tends to blame the world for what happens to him.
Oh, no, he thinks he's a fine, upstanding citizen, you know. Oh, by the way, now, I just realized I would like you to say, if you could, right now, that you found the book funny.
I found the book hilarious. I laughed out loud a bunch of times.
I wanted to, like, leverage that it was funny out of you, because books editors can do this really naughty thing where they take a book and they give it to the complete wrong person to review it, which means a great review, but it just makes life difficult for the person on the receiving end.
It was hilarious. I don't remember the last time I read a novel and laughed out loud so many times.
Music to my ears.
Okay. But I let me tell you, though, that while it was hilarious and while I literally couldn't put it down.
You were entertained against your will.
I was entertained. Well, maybe there's part of that, because I don't quite know how I feel about this book. which, meaning that it's hilarious, but it's 300 pages of vulgarity, almost without lapse.
I try and taunt myself as things progress.
Do you think it's an unfair description?
My editor did say, like, well, can Raymond just have Tourette's? And that way it becomes cute and funny. It's like, no, he's just English, and this is what he does.
You know, I've already seen some reviews of this book, and you've been attacked for it, because Raymond comes across, at least, as misogynist and homophobic and misanthropic and, yeah, all these horrible things. And I don't know a lot about you, but just from what you've written and things you've said, I don't think that you're those things.
Well, that's sort of like, is Angela Lansbury an axe murderer?
Right.
It's the thing about characters, and this is weird, and I've been doing this for 14 books now, is you start writing a book, and then about a quarter of the way in, usually, the characters basically write the book itself, and you're just sitting there channeling it. And so in the case of Raymond, dum-da-dum-da-dum, like, oh my God, I can't believe he just did that. Wait, technically I just did that, didn't I? What's going on here? And of all the characters I've done, he's the one that I don't know where he came from or whatever. He's just like, bleh.
In a way, I find that comforting, because if you were here telling me that, oh yeah, Raymond, I know that guy, I'd be a bit concerned.
I have no idea where, that's characters in general.
Well, you're a literary writer, and again, I couldn't close this book. I felt like there's a point to this, but it's not like there's no redemption.
No socially redeeming value whatsoever. Every book I do is different from the ones that preceded it. Everything new should offer some chance to change the reader in some way. And with this book, kind of want you to feel like, what would it be like to be hit from fire hoses from seven different directions at full blast, and then they turn off, and you're sort of standing there kind of like tingly and little cartoon stars sort of flying around the top of your head. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is just because things have been sort of grim in a lot of ways. And there's sort of this epidemic of earnestness. And why not just go against that trend and write something that might actually damage a person's soul if they read it?
So thank you for damaging my soul.
The opposite. What's the opposite of a vitamin? It's like a
detriment?
It's like one of those hamburgers that has like chicken with like two meat patties as a bun. It is that.
Douglas Copeland, it's been a wild pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thanks so much.
Douglas Copeland's new novel is called Worst Person Ever.
If you've ever sat through a never-ending meeting or a bad movie, you've probably had to resist the urge to look down at your watch. What time is it? So imagine if you could just reach down and feel the time on your wrist. Well, when Hyun-Soo Kim was in business school, he helped design a device that would let you do just that. It's not a watch, it's a timepiece, because you don't have to watch it to know the time. This timepiece, called the Bradley, was designed for the blind. But interestingly enough, it's being bought mostly by sighted people, who will now be able to check the time on the down low. Hyun-Soo joins me in our D.C. studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Who is Bradley and why did he need a new watch?
Yes, we named it after former naval officer Bradley Snyder, who lost his vision in 2011 while he was serving in Afghanistan as a bomb diffuser. But 1 year after the accident, he inspired us by competing in Paralympics in London, and he won 2 gold medals and 1 silver medal. So the Bradley timepiece is a wristwatch that you can tell time by either looking at it or by touching it. So my team started designing it after having realized that most of the mainstream watches and clocks require vision.
Can you hold it up and show me how it works and describe it?
Yes. So the time is indicated by the 2 ball bearings. So one ball bearing, it rotates on the surface, and the other ball bearing, it rotates on the side.
Well, it's a beautiful watch. It has, I guess, chrome markings.
And the face has raised hour markers so that people can feel the reference hours.
Now, weren't there already watches for the blind, some kind of Braille? I mean, I really don't have any idea.
Yeah, so there are 2 types of watches available for the blind. So one is talking watch. I brought it here. Basically, you press a button. It speaks out the time. But soon I realized that people who use this, they don't like pressing the button. First, everyone knows that you're checking time. And second, it draws attention to their disabilities. And the other alternative solution they have is analog watch. You open the glass cover to touch the minute and the hour hand. As you can imagine, it's very fragile. And when you touch them, you can very easily change position of the hands.
Are you surprised that so many sighted people are buying the watch?
While we were developing the concept, we wanted it to be for everyone. So we are very glad that people who are sighted also will liken it.
Hyun-Soo Kim is the founder of E1 Timepieces, the maker of the new Bradley watch. Congratulations.
Thank you.